Blog Talk Radio.
Attention! Army wives, fall in! You are tuned in to the Internet Talk Radio Show designed specifically for Army wives. Our life, our family, our soldier. Brought to you by the Army Wife Network. Interactive empowerment for Army wives, by Army wives. It's Army Wife Talk Radio. Up-to-the-minute information is right here with special reports, stories, interviews, and more. Now reporting for duty, your host, the AWN Core Team.
Hello, Army families. Welcome to Army Wife Talk Radio, the internet podcast designed specifically for you by the Army Wife Network Core Team. I'm your host, Debbie Cunningham.
And I'm your co-host, Courtney Shepherd. Today is Monday, June 19th, 2017, and this is show number 612. We're glad you're here to hang out with us tonight.
Tonight on AWTR, our featured guest is former Air Force officer and current fiction author, Jeffrey K. Walker, here with us to discuss his book, None of Us the Same, the first book of a World War I era trilogy, all featuring strong women characters. Connect with Jeffrey online by going to his website, jeffreykwalker.com, Instagram, jkwalker.author, on Facebook, Jeffrey K. Walker, on Twitter, at jkwalkerauthor, email, jeff@jeffreykwalker.com, or on Goodreads author page, goodreads.com/author/show/16863722.jeffrey_k_walker. Jeff is also hosting a special giveaway tonight. To enter, head over to jeffreykwalker.com and subscribe to his newsletter. When you subscribe, you will automatically receive a thank you gift. 30 sayings you never knew originated during the First World War. All AWTR listeners who subscribe tonight and confirm their intention by responding to the confirmation email will be entered in a drawing, and two will randomly be selected to receive an ebook of None of Us the Same. Be sure to subscribe before midnight tonight. Stay tuned. We've got a great show ahead for you.
If you're listening to our show live, join our fun show discussion currently taking place over on Twitter. Comment on the show, ask questions of our guest, or just hang out and chat with the AWN Core Team. Head over to twitter.com/Army Wife Network and be sure to use #ArmyWife to participate.
Tonight's show is brought to you by our AWTR show sponsor, MetLife. Military spouses do so much for their families. That's why they need life insurance. Enroll today. Learn more at militarybenefit.org or call 1-877-MBA-1020. Courtney, I'm really excited to be hosting the show with you tonight. Let's take a few minutes to catch up. What's happening in your Army wife life lately?
That's a great question. We actually have some really exciting news. Last Thursday, my husband reenlisted for 6 more years into the military, and we actually got Fort Sill, Oklahoma. So we will be PCSing this fall to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. We're really excited because we're originally from Dallas, Texas area, and we've got all of our family down there. His mom is getting remarried in the fall, so we're going to be there for the wedding, and we're real excited about PCSing and doing that great adventure all over again. I think this will be our third PCS, so including the first one, you know. So, yeah, what's going on over in your world, Debbie?
Well, still working and adjusting to that, which has gotten better. But this week, I'm actually sending my daughter, 16-year-old, with a school group to Europe for 2 weeks on a World War II trip. So they're going to be seeing all kinds of sites, just everything history. She's going to 5 different countries. Her best friend is going with her. And she's so excited. We've been planning for this for 2 years. I'm excited, but I'm super nervous because that's, you know, way far.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a really neat thing. And my husband is such a military history buff that he's spent the last, you know, week or more really grilling her and getting her really excited about all these things that she's going to be seeing. And it's just a neat opportunity that came up that we really wanted to jump on, because how often do you get to, you know, travel like that besides military wise, you know, just to be able to go off. Yeah. So we're excited for her. Again, I'm being a hover mom and nervous, but I'm really excited that she gets to see that.
So this is with her school. This goes with her school.
Yeah, it's with her school. And so her history teacher put the opportunity out to some of the top students in her class 2 years back. And if they were, you know, they wanted to stick it out, they could. And that's what she's done. So she's worked to save up her extra money to go. And again, she's excited. She's probably more excited than I can imagine, but it's just a big trip. She did it before. She went to Canada in sixth grade with another school trip. But I don't know. This one just feels a little different for me.
Yeah, I think it's like it's hard now for me. I feel the same way. I'm kind of like hover mom. It's hard for me to even find a good babysitter, you know, like so that I could leave the house. Not them leave the house, but me. I don't know why. It's just I was taking my mom to the airport yesterday. She visited for a week, and we took her to the airport yesterday. And my two girls were with me, along with my husband. And the lady that was standing behind us in line was. I found myself getting a little agitated with my children because they were, you know, acting crazy in the middle of the airport. And I just took a deep breath in. And then the lady told me, they'll grow up, you know, they grow up fast and enjoy that while you got it, you know, is what she kind of was implying to me, which is true. So, you know, I think it's, as they get older, no matter what age, you know, 6 or 16, I mean, it's always difficult to kind of like let them fly, you know?
So, Oh, yeah. It's a neat, motherhood's a neat thing. Definitely interesting. Wow. So, okay, well, we're going to go ahead and move on to our hot topics this week. Hot in military family news, like our civilian counterparts, military families are always looking for ways to save a buck or two. Allegiant Airlines might be just a ticket. The Allegiant Honors Program will cover active duty military, retired military veterans, members of the National Guard, military reserve, and their spouses and dependents. With Allegiant's move, all three of the USA's big ultra-low-cost carriers have now waived baggage fees for active duty military members. Those airlines, Spirit, Frontier, and Allegiant, are the biggest such types in the U.S. They operate business models that promote bargain fares. But the discount fares come with fees for everything from printing a boarding pass to using the overhead bins for carry-on bags. To get the fees waived for the covered Allegiant Honors services, eligible military personnel and their family members should request the items when checking in at the airport. Travelers must show valid military ID to verify their eligibility. Read more about this by going to usatoday.com and look for the story Allegiant to waive fees for military family members, families. A link directly to this story will be posted in our Twitter feed this evening.
Hot on AWN this week, it's no secret that we military spouses are sometimes called to make sacrifices when it comes to supporting our service member. We might put our dreams or goals on hold, waiting until a better time when we don't have to move every couple of years. But AWN experience blogger Sarah says in her blog, You Do You, that perhaps this shouldn't always be the case. In her latest blog post, Sarah shares that although the transient nature of our spouse's profession does pose a significant hurdle, she was able to persist and achieve her dream of earning a bachelor's degree last month. Congratulations to Sarah on receiving her bachelor's degree. And listeners, if you can relate to Sarah's story, read more over on our blog at armywifenetwork.com.
Now, listeners, it's time for a special segment on tonight's show. You might remember that recently AWN was privileged to attend the National Memorial Day concert in Washington, D.C. Sherita Knobloch, our executive officer and deputy commander, was able to chat with many of the performers and even snagged an interview with PBS concert producer Jill Jackson. Let's listen in to what she had to say.
Hello, Army Wife Talk Radio fans and followers. Sherita Knobloch here, your executive officer and deputy commander, broadcasting live from the National Memorial Day concert in Washington, D.C. And today I have with me Jill Jackson, producer of the National Memorial Day concert. And Jill, can you share with us a little bit about this awesome event?
Oh, yes, I would love to. We have been producing the National Memorial Day concert for 28 years. It's an event that happens on the Sunday night, the eve of Memorial Day. The sole purpose of the event is to take the time on this very, very important day of the year to remember those who've paid the ultimate sacrifice for our nation, remember their families, and remember our troops who are deployed in harm's way and doing work at home as well. So we feel that the meaning of Memorial Day it cannot be repeated or remembered too many times. It's, of course, this is a wonderful weekend that begins the summer, and that's all well and good, but there's another deeper meaning that is so important to us. It's important that we do it in our nation's capital. It's important that we do it at the U.S. Capitol. And our sole purpose is to say to military families and servicemen and women, veterans, thank you. We love you. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for making our lives as they are possible.
So why should our listeners tune in to this really interesting and very unique event?
Well, there's so many reasons. I think we have such a mix of content that we're able to share. It's 90 minutes, so of course, if we could go into detail with every story, that we would love to. But what we do is combine the content in a way that you won't see otherwise. We have world-class performers that we just heard in the background at rehearsal, Renee Fleming, the American opera singer, performing. And in this case, she was performing with a wounded warrior who is involved in music therapy, and he has learned to sing even before his speech has fully recovered. So we're able to combine professional musicians, John Andrasik of Five for Fighting, Christopher Jackson from Hamilton is going to do the opening performance, Last Full Measure of Devotion, which the title kind of speaks for itself. So we're bringing together a lot of artists who have military connections. We have Ali'i Carvalho on the show this year. She is the voice of Moana in the animated Disney film. She has lots of military servicemen and women in her family. So we come together. We have performances with the National Symphony Orchestra behind them. So it's a great band, as we say. And we have performers. We have military folks involved. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff attends and speaks. The Joint Chiefs also attend as they can. And we have military choruses from every service. So we're able to showcase the fine musicians in the military. But the heart of it really is the stories that we're able to share. And each year we choose from among the so many things that are interesting and we could do. But we try to focus on our living memorials, so our wounded warriors who are still living with the cost of what have happened to them as a result of serving. We love doing Gold Star family stories because we feel that their stories can never get shared enough. You know, we need to remember them. And we also like to celebrate the heroes that have brought our country to where it is today. So, for instance, this year we're doing a story on Colonel Dick Cole, who is the last living Doolittle Raider for a World War II veteran. So, and we have actors, world-class actors, who portray their stories. So we craft them into a storyline using the real facts, using interviews with the real people, and then the actors stand on stage and share their stories. So you get a short version of the arc of what they've experienced. So it's a lot of, I will say, tissues are kind of a must. So I've been doing this show for 22 years, and it brings me to tears every year just because folks are sharing their hearts. You know, they're sharing their deepest experiences as a way to help the country know what our military men and women are going through.
Well, I definitely say that I'm looking forward to the full production tonight for dress rehearsal and also tomorrow night when we go live. It's just, I'm just super blessed and grateful that you all invited us up here to share in this event. But tell us a little bit more about other events that you all host throughout the year.
We also do a Capitol Fourth, which is our 4th of July show. It happens, it's again broadcast on PBS and takes place on the West Lawn of the Capitol. That, of course, is more a party. We have fireworks, we have uplifting performances. We don't tell stories per se on that one, but we do always do a moment where we honor the troops. So, for instance, this year we're very excited to have Trace Adkins with us, who is such an awesome advocate for our military, and he's such an admirer of our military men and women as well. So that will be a very important moment for us on the Capitol Fourth this year. And we're also involved in a partnership with Blue Star Families.
Jill, what would you like to share with our military families tonight?
Tonight on the National Memorial Day Concert, our most important message to military families is thank you. But even more than that, we love you. We remember. We remember your service, your sacrifice, not only of the servicemen and women, but of their families. And we want to make it clear that our nation has a great amount of gratitude for you.
Anything else you'd like to add?
We'd like you to watch the National Memorial Day Concert and hear our gratitude, and then we'd like to have you come back for the 4th of July and celebrate the freedom, the hard-earned freedom you helped us gain, and we're going to honor you on the 4th of July as well.
Well, thank you so much, Jill. Again, it's an honor to be here and represent Army Wife Network. I've only been here for a few hours just watching rehearsal, and I'm already moved and so anticipating the next 24 or so hours. Thank you so much.
And now it's time to move on to our next segment. Courtney, tell us about our PSA this week.
Well, last but not least, it's public service announcement time. Do you or your business have a military-related PSA? We limit them to one per show and ask for them at least 10 days in advance. Send your PSA to info@armywifenetwork.com. Burn Wise Program of the EPA. If you use a wood stove or fireplace, remember these three tips. First, burn only dry, seasoned wood and maintain a hot fire. Second, have a certified professional inspect and maintain your wood stove or fireplace annually. And third, upgrade to an efficient EPA-approved wood stove or fireplace insert. Remember, burn wise. Burn the right wood the right way in the right wood burning appliance. Visit www.epa.gov/burnwise. Brought to you by the U.S. EPA and Army Wife Talk Radio. That's it for our PSA. Coming up after these quick commercial breaks is our News 6 Lisa bringing you the need to know stories. We'll be right back.
Spends billions of dollars to protect the country. Protecting your family starts at $250 a month. Find out about life insurance from Military Benefit Association. Learn more now.
Uh-huh. Are you looking to reach military families worldwide? Do you have a product or service to offer our listeners? Advertise with the Army Wife Network. AWN has many advertising options specifically designed to reach our military families. Visit ArmyWifeNetwork.com for details. You're listening to the AWTR Live News 6 Report.
Our life, our family, our soldier, news you can use.
Now, with our headlines, it's our own AWN News 6.
Welcome back to Army Wife Talk Radio. Next up is our News 6 report with your need-to-know news. We have Lisa filling in for Jen tonight. Lisa, what news have you brought for us?
Hi, Debbie and Courtney. Tonight's news is about not one, but two women appointed to history-making roles within the Army this past week, bringing girl power to the top ranks. On Friday, the Senate confirmed the appointment of Major General Laura J. Richardson to be the Deputy Commanding General of U.S. Army Forces Command, and Lieutenant Colonel Megan A. Brogdon became the first female to take command of a Special Forces Group battalion.
Wow, hashtag girl power is right. Lisa, can you tell us a bit more about Major General Richardson?
Sure. Richardson, who was promoted to Lieutenant General today, will be the first female Army officer to officially hold the position of Deputy Commanding General for U.S. Army Forces Command. She will report to Fort Bragg to take her new position in early July. Forces Command is the largest command in the U.S. Army, responsible for training and preparing active duty, reserve, and National Guard troops to meet the requirements of combatant commanders around the world. As Deputy Commanding General, Richardson will be heavily involved in ensuring the nation's soldiers are ready for future deployments and contingency operations. Richardson, which was commissioned as an officer in 1986 and spent most of her 30 years of service in Army aviation flying Black Hawk helicopters. She has served in Korea, Fort Campbell, Fort Hood, Fort Myer, and Washington, D.C. She has also been deployed to both Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's awesome. Can you give us some details on Lieutenant General Brogdon and what she will be doing with the Special Forces?
Lieutenant General Brogdon assumed command of the Group Support Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group, on Friday. She is the first woman to assume command of a battalion within any of the Army's 7 Special Forces groups. During her change of command ceremony, leaders made it clear that she was chosen for her expertise and leadership, not because she was a woman. The Group Support Battalion is the largest, most diverse of 5 battalions within the 3rd Special Forces Group. They are charged with supporting Special Forces teams deployed to remote locations in Africa and the Middle East. Brogdon will be in command of the battalion for the next 2 years, and during that time, plans to work on building the reputation of the group and innovating better support for soldiers and their missions. Brogdon has served in Korea, Fort Bragg, Scott Air Force Base, and Fort Lewis as a quartermaster officer. She has also deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait.
Well, Lisa, thanks so much for bringing us these stories of groundbreaking women in the Army. Listeners, stay tuned after this short break for our interview with Jeffrey K. Walker, author of None of Us the Same. You don't want to miss it.
The Breastfeeding Shop is an authorized TRICARE provider for breast pumps and accessories, shipping to all of the USA and worldwide for TRICARE. The Breastfeeding Shop specializes in helping the military moms get the best breast pump possible and prides themselves in providing the best customer service possible, as well as a very quick turnaround time. Check out their easy-to-use online ordering form on their website at www.thebreastfeedingshop.com or call toll-free 866-255-6779. Also visit the Breastfeeding Shop on Facebook and check out the rave reviews from other moms at facebook.com/thebreastfeedingshop.
Want more? ArmyWifeNetwork.com offers discussion boards, military family resources, Loving a Soldier blog, and much, much more. Tell your friends about AWN with our interactive tools. Visit us online at ArmyWifeNetwork.com. ArmyWifeNetwork.com. Interactive empowerment for Army wives.
Welcome back to Army Wife Talk Radio. I'm your host, Debbie Cunningham.
And I'm your co-host, Courtney Shepherd. Tonight, we have with us Jeffrey K. Walker. As an attorney and former law professor, Jeff has been writing all of his professional life, but none of us the same. The title is lifted from a Siegfried Sassoon poem in his first work of fiction, although he jokes that many past opposing counsel might dispute that statement. Jeff is a Midwesterner, born in what was once the glass container capital of the world. A retired military officer, he served Bosnia and Afghanistan, planned the Kosovo air campaign, and ran a State Department program in Baghdad. He says he's been shelled, rocketed, and sniped by various groups, all with bad aim.
Jeff has lived in 10 states and 3 foreign countries, collecting degrees from Harvard, Georgetown, and a few other universities along the way. He's taught legal history, law of war, and international law. He's been a contributor on National Public Radio and a speaker at many federal judicial conferences. Jeff and his wife, Kathy, live in the Tidewater region of Virginia. Their 3 children are spread across the United States. A few fun facts about Jeff. For years, he reread 2 books annually, Pride and Prejudice and A Passage to India. He has a black ink fetish, maybe from his military time. He is a rugby union fan and supports Scotland. He loves watching snooker and darts, too. And finally, he passed the written exam for Jeopardy, but flunked the buzzer test. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, good evening, Courtney and Debbie. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this for weeks.
Well, we're excited you're here to talk to us. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and where you're calling from tonight?
Well, you covered it pretty thoroughly, I think. I did spend 20 years in the Air Force. That's maybe the most germane thing to your listeners. I started out as a B-52 navigator and then retrained in the funded legal education program, which the Army also has. The Air Force sent me to Georgetown to become a JAG, and I spent the rest of my career then after that as a JAG. So about 5 years flying and about 15 years in the JAG. I retired at 20 as a lieutenant colonel. Started a consulting company with some partners, ran that for about 8 years, and then took a job teaching at St. John's Law School in New York City and was there for 5 years as an assistant dean and a professor, and decided I had enough of New York City, and so we came back to Virginia, where, as I told my wife, we're not leaving this house until we move into assisted living.
That's really great.
By the way, we had 10 moves during our 20 years, so we sympathize with your move to Fort Sill.
Wow, that's awesome. That's a lot. So why and how did you become a writer?
A latecomer to fiction writing, certainly. I started my first novel at 56. So I definitely waited a long time to do that. However, you know, as you mentioned, I'm an attorney. I was a professor. I've been writing for a good part of most of my adult life as part of my career. So I came to fiction with a fairly full toolbox for the mechanics of writing English. It's been the kind of world building and character creating and storytelling. It's been a new challenge. And so None of Us the Same has really taught me a lot about the craft of fiction writing.
So just overall, just real quick, what is the book about?
Well, the book is the first of three, all set during the period of and after the First World War. None of Us the Same, as you said, the title pulled from a poem by Siegfried Sassoon, is the three main characters. Deirdre Branigan, who adds new meaning to the word headstrong, I think, is an Irish nurse from working class Dublin. And then two male main characters, one affable Jack Oakley and the much more complicated Will Parsons, who are childhood pals from St. John's, who enlist in the Newfoundland Regiment the day it's formed at the start of the war in August 1914. Deirdre joins a military nursing service after her father and her brother hit the beach at Gallipoli. So all three of them are in the war, and their paths cross at Deirdre's field hospital on the first day of the very tragic Battle of the Somme in 1916. Each of them suffers terrible and quite varied trauma from the war. And the second half of the book returns to Newfoundland as they come to a reckoning with their self-pity, their addictions, their emotional devastation, all their baggage from the war. A big part of the healing process involves overlapping romantic and business relationships, and not all of them entirely legal, let me say.
Well, Jeff, real quick, before I ask my next question, I'd like to go back. So could I ask you, I know I asked you why and how you became a writer, but I really wanted to know what made you choose writing as opposed to the other endeavors that you've had in your life with business and that sort of thing?
Well, some of my friends say, if you look at my resume, it's because I can't hold a job. But I can't. I think I'm on my fifth career. I had to stop and count, I suppose. It's something I've always had an inkling to do. I think I'm a pretty good storyteller. My kids might dispute that. They've probably heard a lot of my stories dozens of times. But it's something I really always wanted to try. When we were in New York, I loved the teaching. I loved being surrounded by wannabe lawyers who are excited about the profession, but my wife and I just decided we needed to get out of New York City. And
right.
My wife said, hey, why don't you've always wanted to do this. Let's do this. Let's go back to Virginia and let's make this work. So my retired 20-year Air Force wife is the one who really sort of, I think, pushed me to take up the challenge of something I've been talking about and noodling around with for years.
Wow. So after all of that, how did you approach researching the book?
I've been a big historical fiction fan since I was a kid. I remember reading my parents' Book of the Month Club selections. Do they still have Book of the Month Club? I don't even know if that still exists.
Somewhere,
but
probably.
I remember, I honestly don't know. I mean, it seems like you just go to Amazon and buy a book now. But
I know, right?
I remember picking up, probably age 11 or 12 or so, a James Michener book. It must have been Hawaii, because that's the only one I think fits into that time. Totally age inappropriate for me, I'm sure. But I completely fell in love with it. And Michener is such a meticulous researcher in all of his great historical books. So I kind of started with this high bar, and I put that burden on myself. I hate books with sort of historical groaners in them, and my wife will tell you I literally groan out loud when I read just groaning inaccuracies. And I know that military people have read books, you know, with military scenarios and characters where they do the same thing. That seems to be an area where a lot of people really mess up facts and details. But so I really put that on myself. I needed to avoid all the groaners, really get a lot of historical accuracy in this. So I knew a fair amount about this period just from my own academic background and my own pleasure reading over the years, I suppose. But so that wasn't that big of a challenge for me. But what I really wanted to do, and this is the big difference, I think, between writing professional, you know, legal briefs and writing fiction, was I wanted to get the sound and the feeling of that period in my head. So besides all the what you'd think of as the historical books I went to read, of all the detailed books, and there's stacks of them in my office where I'm sitting right now, by the way, but I went back and started reading trench diaries, as they were called, of private soldiers, of enlisted troops. I read memoirs, and the ones closest to the war, the better, because some of them were 30 or 40 years later. You know, the rose-colored glasses were put on. I loved reading collections of letters. There's lots of those. Most of them out of print, but you can find them in, as used books. And I read a lot of the fiction that was written by veterans, both men and women. For example, that the title pulled from a Siegfried Sassoon poem. Getting the sound of the voices from that time, getting the way, a kind of a way they view the world, was really important to me. And it just made these people come alive for me and in ways that really surprised me. I didn't suspect how vivid it would be. I hope I passed a little bit of that along into the book as well. I guess that's up to the readers to decide.
So I actually downloaded the book last week so that I could see what it was about. And I was wondering, as I started reading, were the characters based on actual historical people, or are they 100% fictional?
They're about as 100% fictional as I think any character can be. I'll tell you this. I didn't have anybody particularly in mind. I didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write this character like my best friend Bob. That never occurred to me when I was writing the book or the second one that's in second draft right now. But great example, the character of Deirdre Brannigan, as I said, a highly opinionated Irish woman. When I went back and looked at that when we got to the final draft, it just occurred to me that she was a composite of all the strong Irish American women I grew up with, grandmothers and great aunts and mothers and sisters and cousins and daughters and everything else. So I think that sort of sneaks into it. But that said, I've always been a little bit averse to historical fiction that has really well-known historical characters in it. And I didn't really want to do that. I don't think anybody does it. Well, I shouldn't say anybody. There's not a lot of people that do it really, really well. Hilary Mantel, who writes the Wolf Hall series, which I know some of your readers are probably familiar, or listeners are familiar with, does it really well, for example. But I just was uncomfortable doing that. So there are no characters in this book, for example, named soldiers in this book above the rank of platoon commander. So there's I could use really anonymous characters. I pulled names of characters, for example, last names I was concerned about from regimental rosters and from old St. John's city directories for the regiment, the soldiers from the regiment. But that's really as far as I went. There are references to some historic people, but you don't meet any of them. Mm-hmm. So I liked keeping it as the attention on the experience of these individuals, how the war affected them, and how they put their lives back together, rather than, oh, he doesn't sound like Winston Churchill. Poor Churchill, I swear. I wish they'd just leave poor Churchill alone. He appears in I think, half the historical novels I read. Anyway.
You know, Jeff, I'm really glad that Debbie and I got to interview you tonight, because this is, like, right up my alley. I was an English major in college, and I was a big English and history buff in high school, and I just kind of always keep up with it, too. Our family vacations don't consist of, you know, tan lines and whatnot. They consist of, you know, history and things like that. So I really, really love that, you know, you have an interest in this kind of history. None of us the same is set during and after the First World War. But what is it about the time period that these characters you know, the time period and these characters that intrigued you and motivated you to write about them?
I think I've been attracted to the period of World War I for a long time, even I think more so than World War II, which may sound kind of odd coming from an American. The Brits and the Canadians and the Aussies and the New Zealanders, and they're all much more attuned into their history of World War I than we are. Part of it because the United States was only in it for the last third. We only got into it 100 years ago this April. The Brits and the Europeans and the Aussies have been commemorating the First World War centennial for 3 years now, and we just started. So I found, well, when I first started thinking about writing this book, I wanted to deal with this theme of war changes everything and everybody, and then what? And I initially thought set it present day. But very quickly, I got this feeling that there are so many young vets and still active duty soldiers who are struggling with these problems real time, that I felt like I was kind of appropriating their stories, and it just didn't feel right to somebody who spent 20 years in uniform. So I suppose in one way I was a bit of a coward, and so I went to World War I. All those people are dead, but I think you'll be surprised, your listeners would be surprised if they read the book, the immediacy of the problems, how modern and how present day, especially very sophisticated listeners like yours who know a lot about the problems of coming home from war. I think it rings, the problems are so modern. And it allowed me a lot more flexibility, and I could get over these feelings that I was stealing some young vet stories.
You think as though it kind of gives them a voice?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Do you think as though it almost gives them a voice, you know, instead of stealing? That's what I would think.
In some ways, I hadn't really thought that through, but that's a great question. I felt, you know, let me say it this way. A lot of authors, and I thought this is all sort of, you know, new agey, huggy-feely sort of stuff that authors always sort of do when they get together. But this idea of I can't hear my characters, or I can hear my characters speaking to me. And the reality is you do. That you construct these characters, and you're so immersed in them, and you know, look, they're your creations. The most frightening part of me when writing the first draft is when one of the characters stopped talking to me and I had to go try to find his voice again. They really do sort of, that sounds a little bit, like I say, new agey, but it really does sort of happen. And you have to get the sound of their voice in your head. Otherwise you can't write true dialogue. I don't think it comes out clunky and kind of, you know, rigid if you don't actually sort of hear their voices in your head. So anyway.
Right. So I'm going to piggyback real quick on Courtney's question. What do you think is, what do you think our modern families can learn from those past situations?
I think one of the biggest things that dawned sort of slowly on me was just that sense of we're not alone in this, that we're not the first to have gone through this. I mean, everybody feels like when they're going through trauma personally or in someone you love in your home, that you're sort of an island, that you're the first ones to have to go through this. It's one of the reasons why support groups in the military, for example, and any organization are so important in these contexts. But I think this notion that people have been struggling with these same problems for a very long time, and we really have come a long way. The treatment. Let's talk about PTSD. In World War I, called shell shock, the term post-traumatic stress disorder did not exist. It was the first conflict where medical profession really tried to treat it as a diagnosable condition. There had been a little bit about something going on with soldiers coming home from war after the Civil War. You heard people talking about a kind of melancholia, as they called it back then. They referred to a soldier's heart. They had a melancholy heart when they came back from war. It became a little more scientifically rigorous in World War One, certainly, that it may be that as many as 25% of the soldiers who serve in the front line, which is about equivalent to what medical professionals are saying coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq today, almost identical mm-hmm. percentages of soldiers, both private soldiers and officers, enlisted and officers, suffering from the effects of what we would call PTSD, shell shock. They thought it was because of these horrible, high explosive, prolonged bombardments. You sat in a hole in the ground in a trench, in a bunker, in a dugout, and you got shells, sometimes nonstop for 6 days. So that's what their first guess was. But they did try to develop some sort of treatment for this with some specialized hospitals. There was great strides made by a team of doctors at a hospital called Craig Lockhart in Edinburgh. In fact, there's a great series of books written by Pat Barker that won the Man Booker Prize back in the 90s called The Regeneration Trilogy that was based on men, officers being treated in Craig Lockhart. It's brilliant, brilliant books, by the way. There was, however, and this might sound kind of familiar, there was this decided divide between the way military medicine treated officers suffering from shell shock and enlisted troops suffering from shell shock. The officers were considered, well, they're just gentlemen who have been worn out and taxed to their extreme. All they need is some rest and some good food and some exercise, and they'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, resulted in a lot of these officers being sent back to the front woefully too soon, where they just degenerated again. The enlisted troops didn't fare quite as well in World War One. That there was a notion that enlisted troops, not being gentlemen, quote unquote, were slackers or cowards. That must be what's at the basis of this. So what they needed was military discipline, up to and including courts martial, which is kind of outrageous. Although, you know, remember that famous scene in the movie Patton, and George C. Scott slaps the in World War II battle fatigue was the term, the battle fatigue soldier. So it didn't go away between the wars. Certainly, there was this prolonged sense that there was a moral failing here, and I think there's some of that. We can hear echoes of that today. Soldiers that are afraid to report symptoms.
Right.
I'll lose my security clearance, or I'll get redlined for promotion, or. That there's still some of that sense of stigma when this is really just a medical condition that needs to be treated and recognized as such. And that was the first baby steps towards that really began in the First World War.
This is just so fascinating to me, where you were connecting all these, from way back then to now. It's amazing. But we do need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion about World War One and its importance to your writing process. Listeners, don't forget, if you're listening to our show live right now, the AWN Core team is hanging out in Twitter chat. Join in the conversation and ask questions of our guests by going to twitter.com/ArmyWifeNetwork and use hashtag ArmyWife to participate. Make sure to click on the Live tab to get real-time chat updates. We'll be right back with more Army Wife Talk Radio in just a moment.
To the men and women of our armed forces, the greatest armed forces on the planet, we as Americans are humbled by your sacrifice and what you do to protect the principles of our Constitution and our way of life. We are forever grateful. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, from the Patrick family in the Hollywood Hills of California.
You're listening to Army Wife Talk Radio live here on the Army Wife Network. Our live show is broadcast every Monday night. Join us in our live chat room at blogtalkradio.com/AWTR. Missed the live show or just can't make it? Don't worry. AWTR is available in archived format 24/7 via our website, www.armywifenetwork.com, or on iTunes. It's interactive empowerment for Army Wives by Army Wives. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking with Jeffrey K. Walker, former Air Force officer and current fiction author. Before we went to break, we were discussing the influence of the history of World War I and its influence on your book and how it's kind of taken it forward to, you know, correlating everything to today and what our military goes through. So, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit more about why you find the First World War such an important event in history, even more so than the Second World War?
Well, at the risk of angering a lot of people, I guess I'll have to say that I always saw World War II as sort of the final act of this horrible drama that played out over a period of about 35 years. And the opening act, the overture in the opening act certainly was the First World War. What the First World War really represented, I think, is the first truly industrial war, if that makes sense. Think about the time. This was after 7,500 years of industrialization. And what happened was we found out that if we could mass produce Model T Fords or Edison light bulbs, we could mass produce death and destruction as well. Millions and millions of artillery shells that were consumed every few months on the Western Front alone. So this notion that we can mass produce the violence of war was a big watershed moment for better or for worse, I would say for worse, in Western civilization. The other part was you had all of the greatest economic powers in the world at that time engaged on one side or the other of that conflict with these enormous mass citizen conscripted armies. Now, the United States came into the war with just over 100,000 people in the entire active duty army. A lot of them were on garrison duty in the Philippines or chasing Pancho Villa down the Mexican border or whatever. But so from April 1917 or 16, when the United States 17, the United States entered the war, until the end of the war, 11 November 1918, the United States put 8 million men in uniform. It was an enormous logistics problem. It was an enormous production problem. It was an enormous pull on the industrial capacity of the United States, which, by the way, in the early going, we were sending a lot of troops to Europe that were being outfitted by the British and the French because the United States factories had to be retooled for the wartime footing. And it took a better part of a year for the mass production of the United States to be able to crank out, you know, the ridiculously large amounts of munitions that we're able to do, for example, in the Second World War, much earlier in the conflict. So the other piece of it, I think, was it really sort of broke the world in some ways, that confident, almost arrogant Victorian sense of progress is always good and science will always come up with good answers and good results. You had millions and millions of men, and then their families and their loved ones and the civilians that were displaced or killed during the war as well, that suddenly realized that progress can lead to some really horrible things too. Like this horrible sausage grinding conflict along hundreds of miles of trench running through France and Belgium. So it was sort of when the bubble popped, that confidence, that reliance that everything will always work out well because of technical and scientific and industrial progress, and life will just get better and better and better. And people came out of that war, this is if you read the writers, the great fiction writers in particular, so completely disillusioned, which opened up the space for what became the Roaring Twenties. You know, let's be sexually liberated. Let's be culturally liberated. Let's drink. Let's have fun. Let's carouse. Let's reinvent music. Let's reinvent art. That was sort of the good part that came out of it. This opening, this great flowering of freedom, of cultural and personal and social freedom after the war. But it also opened up the space for some darker forces that you'd see as fascism and Nazism because of the unanswered problems remaining from the war, like the really bad peace that was imposed at Versailles on the Germans and the Austrians. So, you know, it made space for some evil to come in as well. And it, really that last act of the Second World War, where we really, the world got together and really consciously sort of re-engineered the world order, the United Nations and all those institutions and that sort of thing, was what Woodrow Wilson and others attempted to do at the end of the First World War, and it wasn't possible. It wasn't politically possible at the time. So,
well, I've got a question about your the book setting. So the book is partly set in Newfoundland. What drove you to choose Newfoundland of all places?
Yeah, Newfoundland, kind of the edge of the world, right?
Right.
I started, when I decided it was going to be set in World War One. I knew I had to have some group of soldiers that I had to set this in somehow to get the conflict part in there. And I started looking at what were called PALS battalions, that were raised by the British Army early on in the First World War. It sort of went like this. Oh, get together with all the guys from your factory and all enlist together, and you can all go in the same battalion of the same regiment and fight together. Or everybody who graduated from this high school should join up. Or everybody who was, this is a true case, the 16th Royal Scots, all the players and fans of the Heart of Midlothian soccer team should all join up together, and you can form your own battalion, and you can go off to war together. Kind of sort of like the Guard, I guess, but not, I mean, the Guard is not quite like you know, that sort of construction. But, I mean, the Guard is raised locally at the state level normally. But these are literally people who were fans of the same soccer team or went to the same high school. So that seemed to work out okay until the 1st of July 1916. I'm only 100 years off. The first day of the Somme, a lot of these PALS battalions went over the top. And you had an entire generation of young men from a town or a high school or a factory wiped out in one morning. And they realized what a colossally horrible mistake they made. So looking at those PALS battalions with their tragic, but you know, they're glorious in some ways, but tragic history, I ran across the Newfoundland regiment by accident. They weren't a true PALS regiment, but they were, you know, it was a regiment that was raised from a dominion on the edge of the British Empire with about a little over 200,000 people. So they basically were. Everybody knew everybody. So they were like a PALS battalion. And I really got attracted by this idea of these young men, like all the other young men all around the world, excited to go off for the challenge and the glamour and, you know, all the things you think war is going to be that it's not. But in this sort of pristine location on the edge of the British Empire, unspoiled, naturally beautiful, stunning location, and being able to contrast that to the mud and the violence and the noise of the Western Front in France and having to go back to that. To me, this seemed really, really attractive. And when it came to my wife and I making the decision we were going to make a research trip to Newfoundland, we just absolutely fell in love with the place. By the way, bucket list item, visit Newfoundland. Preferably during iceberg season, which is May and June.
Then learn to pronounce it right on my end.
Yeah. The only reason I know how to do that is because I had about 50 Newfoundlanders correct me while I was in Newfoundland.
That would have been me. That definitely would have been me, for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what. One of the hardest things to do when I made that decision was to write the Newfoundland accent, the Newfoundland dialect. If I wrote it like it actually is spoken, no one would be able to read the book probably. and it can vary just 20 miles. You can go from one fishing town in one bay to 25 miles away to another one. They'd been historically isolated for centuries, and they have totally different accents.
It was really where I'm from, Texas.
but like island, I think like island people the world over, Newfoundlanders are so incredibly generous and welcoming and warm. I've never run across people that are willing to share everything immediately like they are. just really amazing, amazingly warm and welcoming people. So yeah, I would put Newfoundland on my bucket list for anybody that's looking. By the way, Canadian dollar, really cheap right now, so Canada is a good deal to travel in.
Hey. So, Jeff, since I still have to finish reading the book, and don't give away any spoilers, what's your favorite scene or event in the book?
Hey, there's you know, writers get asked that all the time, I know, and it's hard because they're all your darlings, right? The very first scene in the book, I think, is really kind of fun, that it takes place in Deirdre Branigan, the main female character's charity hospital,
right,
where she's supervising a clutch of, if you've read that part, then you know where I'm going, a clutch,
yes,
of trainee nurses, one of whom has a rather unusual problem with man parts, let us say. It is at the end of that scene that all the church bells have doubled.
Interesting scene.
I hope you liked it. It was.
I did.
I hesitated.
It threw me off for a little bit, but it was very interesting.
I hesitated for a bit, but it says a lot about the character of Deirdre Branigan, the main female character, I think, too. Just how bold and unafraid she is. But at the end of that scene, all the church bells of Dublin begin to ring, and Deirdre hears them coming to the windows, because the declaration of war on Germany was just announced, and so all the excitement is going now. I really like that scene, but I had to really pick one. I love the lighthouse scenes. There's three scenes sprinkled through the book take place at lighthouse run by or kept by the uncle of one of the main characters, which is just a guilty pleasure getting to write narrative about the beautiful Newfoundland coast and these cool lighthouses. But I think if I had to pick one, it's probably be main character Will Parsons' experience on the 1st of July, 1916, the first day of the Somme. It would be hard to write a more horrible fictional account than the reality of that day. From a macro scale, from a bird's eye view, it was just this horrendous moment. The British alone, the French and the Germans were involved in this fight too, don't forget. The British alone in 3 hours that morning had 20,000 men killed. Not casualties, but killed. Many, many more wounded and missing. So it was you couldn't make up anything worse than the reality of the Somme, but I really wanted to look at it from one young lieutenant's point of view and how from the confusion of his little slice of the battlefield with his little group of men, the confusion and the mayhem and the violence and the terror of that day affected him. And I like to go back and reread that scene myself. I think I got it right. And a lot of readers have said that they found that scene very, very powerful. And it really is a pivotal scene that sets the stage, certainly for Will, for the rest of the book at that point. So, and that would probably be my favorite.
That's awesome. I love talking about this book, but can you tell us anything about the upcoming second and third books in your Sweet Wine of Youth trilogy?
Yeah, Sweet Wine of Youth, by the way, is a title lifted from another, what they call the Lost Generation, the World War One writers. He was literally lost, Rupert Brooke, who was killed at the end of the war. What he called the Sweet Red Wine of Youth is how we refer to the blood being spilled by soldiers. I just found that phrase so moving that I couldn't get
it
out of my mind.
Yeah, when you just said it, I was like, hey,
that is... Well, the second... It's not a true series. Each book is standalone, so you can pick it up in any order and read them. They share characters, they share a time period, and they have kind of dovetailing plots, if that makes any sense. Example, two minor characters in book one are main characters in book two. In book three,
oh, wow,
the main characters in the action revolves around Deirdre Branigan's family in Ireland. So again, the plot lines are dovetailed together. So there's little Easter eggs planted in the books of little things to come in the next volumes. But you can read them completely separately. Truly Are the Free, the second volume, is in second draft. My wife's reading it right now. Hopefully have a third draft done soon, and it should be out in the fall. It takes one of the characters from the Newfoundland Regiment, who's an American, who, when the U.S. enters the war, goes back to join the U.S. forces. And he is a white Bostonian Irish American who was assigned as an officer to a black regiment. In fact, the historically famous Harlem Hellfighters, the 369th Infantry from New York. And the history of the Harlem Hellfighters is a remarkable story of valor and bravery. And in the face of systemic prejudice back home that follows them to France. So it's just an amazing story of these men who fought not only against the enemy, but also against prejudice and exclusion from their own country and their own forces. Really fascinating. It also examines the war from a French woman's point of view as well. So that's a really interesting one. The third volume is called No Heroes Welcome. And I just started writing it about a week ago, so I'm just into the first draft right now.
Oh, wow.
And it is set in Ireland, focusing mostly on the events that are triggered in Ireland by the war, the Irish War of Independence, and then quick on the heels of that, the Irish Civil War. What I really was looking at doing was trying to get kind of approaching this question of war changes everyone and everything in three different ways. None of us the same looks at it from a very personal level, how war hurts individuals and how individuals have to try to pick up the pieces and move on. The second book, Truly Are the Free, I really wanted to examine it, but still using really strong individual characters, but examine the great social and cultural changes that were caused by the war and the experience of these African-American soldiers at war and then coming home after was the perfect vehicle for that. And then finally, I wanted to look from sort of the 10,000-foot big political changes that were caused by the war and examining what happened in Ireland, all of the pent-up rebellious genies that were uncorked in Ireland by the First World War. And I had this ready-made, really interesting family from the first book, Deirdre Brannigan's family, that I could use as the vehicle for telling that story. So it's just been a huge amount of fun. My alternative would have been to have written, you know, a Ken Follett sized 800-page doorstopper. And I don't think, as a brand new writer, a lot of people were going to give me the chance to read an 800-page tome. So
Jeff, we're so many of our listeners are excited with all the stuff you've given us with your trilogy. Where can they go to learn more about the current book, None of Us the Same?
You can always go to my author website, which is just jeffreykwalker.com. There's information there and links. If you want to buy the book, which would make me supremely happy, the best place, of course, is to go to Amazon. You can get Kindle books or print, either one. It's up on Barnes & Noble as in print as well. So a couple of places where you can get the book. If you want to, you can find me in all the usual places as well. I know you ran through some of those at the beginning of the show. I won't do all that again. But you can always just go to, J.K. Walker author on Twitter or Jeffrey K. Walker on Facebook. If you go to Goodreads, just search Jeffrey K. Walker. It's easier than the long URL that goes with it. But definitely love you to go to my website. Love you to sign up for my newsletter. You'll get the cool little illustrated 30 sayings you didn't know originated in World War I. I found really fascinating things like louse and brass hat and called on the carpet and things like that. Demo comes from World War I. So I'd love to have you on my mailing list. I don't sell my list. I'm not a spammer. Maybe once or twice a month, so it wouldn't be too painful. And you get a chance to win one of the two free Kindle books we're giving away. The other thing I would throw in is I know you've got listeners who are in book clubs. I am happy to Skype in and do an author talk to anybody's book club.
Wow.
And anywhere in the world. I'll get up at 3 o'clock in the morning if you've got a book club in Japan. Happy to do that. You can reach me through my website, jeffreykwalker.com, and I would be more than happy to make an author appearance via Skype.
That's awesome.
And answer questions.
That's awesome. Side note, too, I mean, I would personally love this, too, but if any listeners right now would just hop over on Twitter and tweet at us and at Jeffrey, if you're a history buff or military buffs, you know, the history behind it. But I would love to see how many of our listeners are like that. I think Debbie would too. Like, I know Debbie's like really into this stuff as well. And, you know, she just bought your book, but I would love to see how many listeners do that. And I think that's amazing that, you know, Jeff is willing to get on, you know, book clubs, virtual book clubs and things like that. I need one of those.
Yeah, I think virtual book clubs are tailor made for military spouses, to tell you the truth.
I believe it
would be great. And the book is less than 300 pages. It's a good book club length. A lot of early readers actually are nominating it for their book clubs as well. So it seems like it's got a little bit of resonance with book club readers.
That would be also another way for spouses to get together and, you know, make friends. That's a great way to do that.
Well, Jeff, I hate to cut it short, but it's about that time. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest this evening. It's been a wonderful hour talking to you and getting to learn about your book and just putting this all together. It was just fascinating for me. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us and share about your experience as an author of your first fiction novel, None of Us the Same. And we look forward to hearing more about the other two books in the Sweet Wine of Youth trilogy when they become available.
Well, thank you, ladies. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on, and maybe we can talk again sometime.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to enter the special giveaway that Jeff is hosting for our listeners this evening. Head over to Jeff's website at jeffreykwalker.com and subscribe to his newsletter. When you subscribe, you will automatically receive a thank you gift. 30 sayings you never knew originated during the First World War. All AWTR listeners who subscribe tonight and confirm their intention by responding to the confirmation email will be entered in a drawing, and two will be randomly selected to receive an ebook of None of Us the Same. Be sure to subscribe before midnight tonight. Also, be sure to join us next week, June 26, 2017, when our featured guest will be Gina Elise, discussing her experience with a nonprofit organization.
In the meantime, join us on armywifenetwork.com to stay connected to resources, information, expert columnists, and share the journey with many of our experienced contributors, or follow along on any of our social media outlets such as Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram.
Interactive empowerment for Army Wives by Army Wives. This is Army Wife Network's core team signing out.
The views and opinions expressed in our show are personal. Army Wife Talk Radio is in no way affiliated with the Department of Defense or any other branch of the armed services, and inclusion in our show does not reflect endorsement by the DOD, any local government, or their agencies. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week for another informative edition of Army Wife Talk Radio.